The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
And welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. My name is Ian Higgins. It has been a long, hard, cold, freezing, frosty winter. That's a lot of adjectives unnecessarily, but it is so good to be back in your ears and in your hearts, hopefully. I'm joined from London by Sam Perry, who joins us now. Sam, hi, welcome.
Hello, he goes. Hello, everybody. I was tempted there, he goes, to have a like an enforced delay, like I'm some sort of correspondent with bad technology. And I suppose that is the first thing off the bat. If you do hear any Skype chimes or just fractionally less sophisticated technology than you heard last year, then it's because, well, it's my fault. I'm in London. And, you know, hopefully, he goes, it stays with us. Hopefully, Turnbull's NBN helps us out. As we embark on this very, very long... So far it hasn't, let's just say that from the top. But we want to do it. We want to do a long series of podcasts all throughout the Australian summer. And I will continue to say the Australian summer and defend my my London and UK compadres here. You know, other things exist, guys. And talk about long, cold winters. I think that is coming up for me. But let's just say from the top he goes as well, there is a conspicuous absence on the show. Dave is not joining us today. And just to explain that, this will be a long-running series. And, you know, to be honest, being available all of the time is difficult for the three of us. So Dave will chime in when he can, and I'm sure it will be the same for us as well. So there'll be combinations of us throughout the summer, and we'll see how we go.
I can literally hear half of our audience clicking off now because they say, no Dave, no fun, which is actually, my tattoos. No Dave, no party, which is what my tattoo says clearly. Pez, we've had a lot of questions come in from Ask TGC, one of our most revered segments of the show, which we'll get to a little bit later on. Hashtag Ask TGC. But a few questions have actually come in specifically asking us what we've been doing over the winter, which is... I don't know if it's nice or scary. Like, I don't know if it's nice that people want the interpersonal relationships between podcaster and listener, or they're stalking us. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, we barely ask each other what we've been up to, just like normal men, I guess. So I think that's actually a nice point to say thanks to the people who have been interested in when the podcast is coming back as well. So hopefully we can give you something that you enjoy. What have we been up to? He goes, well, yeah, I guess you... kind of described most of what I've been up to. I've been over here in London with my wife and my dog, Florimo, who we flew over at great expense. If you do hear him running around, that's because, well, he's still alive because we paid for him to come over and he should be eternally grateful, but I do love him. That aside, that's good, isn't it? That aside, you would think, he goes, wouldn't you, that, you know, moving over to London should be like a harbinger of like culture and trips through Europe. And there has been a little bit of that. There's been some theatre and I've gone overseas and done the Eurostar thing and all that sort of stuff. But I did also just end up playing cricket again, which has been good because it's, yeah, you know, you just do what you know.
Always but, returns what you know.
Well, I had no friends coming over, so the first thing I thought was I'd join a cricket club. I did. So I was lucky enough to play, and this is, I think you helped him with this,
you
guys, and so
him?
Did Dave. Yeah, exactly. Well, average 47 over four games, but we won't go through that. But I played for a wandering side called the Authors 11. Like, they have things like that over here, like a bunch of people who get together to actually hang out and talk and be a community. And this side's called the Authors 11. You can only play for it if you've written a book. And I only was allowed to play sort of a third of the games because I'm you know, a third of the great cricketer. But it's this great side of like historians and young children's authors and literary agents and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we got to play in some really nice grounds, and we played against teams called things like the Thespian Thunderers, which is, you know, full of actors. You know, you can only be in that side if you've been on the West End. or you know, the Archbishops of Canterbury 11, which is you have to believe in God, I suppose. So they were actually, yeah, they were a tough team. But I had a really good time. And it, exactly. Yeah, with God on their side, etc. Yeah, very good. But had a good time.
Would I be right in saying this sounds fucking village?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, don't get me wrong, like I joined this side because I wanted to get away from the like hyper aggression of grade cricket, etc. I was like, finally I'll be able to sort of see what it's like to play cricket for reasons other than just alphaing people and trying to, you know, continue living dreams that died years ago. I can just actually enjoy the game because English people do that very well. That kind of stereotypically genteel way. And what I found was that is true. They do enjoy the game and everything around it. The grounds are beautiful. It's nice little pastel colours. People are friendly with each other and they don't sledge. But after the game, I essentially got feedback from the entire team that they were disappointed with how I played because I didn't come as the Aussie sledger. They sort of secretly wanted me to be that guy. And I didn't want to be that guy, so I've still sort of got some identity work to do around who I am.
There is something about the English that you'll obviously pick up on, and that's that like the English people really love their Australians to be as Australian as possible. Just like as big a cliche as you like they all they'll talk about is barbecues, shrimp, etc., and just hyper aggression. That's what they want their Australian men to be.
Yeah, I think that that's right, by and large. Yeah, we're animals to them. So hello to 40% of our English fans out there. So it's speaking of people clicking off
exactly.
Just now. Just a bit of casual racism to start. I love being here in England. And I love English people. Let me be clear. It's just banter. He goes, "What? I'm going to stop talking. What have you been up to?"
Mate, well, it's been a long time, obviously, without the boys in my life, talking to you on a weekly basis. Of course, one of the biggest things that we've done since we finished the podcast pre-India tour, is that we wrote another book, and we'll get into that later. And unfortunately, Dave isn't here because obviously he's a huge contributor to that. But so that's something that we did. I suppose I also finished a law degree, but that's not interesting to anyone because what the most interesting thing that's happened to me is that I played one game of cricket at the beginning of this year.
Great.
And what happened with that was I started the game and immediately realized I'd made a huge mistake.
Here you go. Just to stop you, can we just wind it back a little bit? Can you tell us about why you decided to play, what the approach was from this person, and just some of the thoughts that you may have had leading into it? You know, did you think this could be your resurrection? Did you think you could kind of resolve or reconcile your feelings about cricket in this way? You know, you graduated from law. You're a more mature man. Perhaps you were going to see different elements of cricket that you never had before. Did any of that happen? Why'd you do it?
Nah. So what happened was I'm living with a bloke who is the captain of a team, and he has been trying to get me to play for his team for about 10 years. And so I caved in because it's very hard to escape all the, not the taunts, but all the invitations to say, mate, you've got to come and play. And now that he knew that I wasn't doing anything on Saturdays, because obviously we weren't writing a book anymore and I wasn't studying anymore, so I didn't have anything else to do. So he said, well, you know, come down and play. And I thought, I just didn't have it. I didn't have it in me to say that I hate cricket and it's killed every single ounce of me. That's not true.
But, every ounce.
But he... But so I said, go on then, I'll play the first game and I'll see how I get along. So... So, and also it was a free lift to the game. So that was that sort of, subs paid for and I didn't have to bring tea. So, you know, that really ticked a lot of boxes. So played the game. We lost the toss. We were fielding. It was just a 1 day game, first game of the season. The other team got 250 or something. And I was out on the boundary. I was boundary riding and I spent a lot of time fetching sixes. And I was just thinking then, it's just like, I could be doing anything else, but I'm at deep mid-wicket to a bloke bowling halfway down the wicket, excuse me, and to fetch balls over the fence. So that was the part of it. And then when I came into bat, I faced about three balls and I thought, I thought, this is it. This is my last ever innings. I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be there. I'd had enough of cricket, and I'd given it everything in my life. And cricket's been great to me, obviously. But there was like a really bad off-spinner bowling, and I attempted to cut a ball, and I was dismissed bowled. And it was just yuck. It was a bad shot. I knew it was a bad shot. But I was in some way relieved that was the last time I'd ever be dismissed and the final part of grieving of my cricket career had begun. And as I, like, turned round, the bowler just said, "That's a fucking shit shot." And I thought, yeah, he's right. He's right. I mean, he probably wouldn't play sixth grade, but he's right. It was a bad shot. And so I walked off the field. The team chased down 250. One bloke got 120. We won the game with two balls to spare. And I just felt nothing. I felt nothing for this amazing victory of chasing down 250 in a one dayer with two balls left. I felt nothing. Didn't care.
Continuing on an important theme, he goes, because really, like, I'm sure that this podcast and everything that we've done with the grade cricket is essentially an exercise in therapy. Like, we're trying yeah, to understand what this thing means. So like, I feel like I'm just on the couch listening to you deal with that at the moment. Are you feeling a bit better about it now?
I feel better that I've, you know, finally committed to not playing anymore. But you know what? It's funny because I look back on, like, all my playing days, and definitely the highlight for me was playing in England. And I think it was because you're allowed to enjoy it in England. Like, you actually are really allowed to enjoy playing cricket in England. Whereas in Australia, it's be good or fuck off. And I've done the latter.
He goes, speaking of the winter and things that have been going on in the off season, we thought we might just do a bit of a recap of the, you know, the state of the nation of Australian cricket and the things that have been going on since we've been on hiatus. I thought we perhaps could each bring sort of one thing that we thought was the most pivotal part of the off season or the biggest highlight of the non-Australian cricket season. Does anything spring to mind for you there?
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for me is, like, the India series, which now feels like an absolute lifetime ago, given that there's been a lot of things happening, pay disputes, obviously that Bangladesh tour. I think Australia played some one days in India recently. Don't get me wrong, the JLT Cup has been a huge highlight for me as well, as long as all of our listeners, especially those from the UK. But that India series, I mean, we finished the podcast at the beginning of this year, and we just thought, I think every single person we spoke to thought it was going to be 4-0. England had been there a few months prior, lost 3-0. No, they lost 4-0. And so I think I said that a good result for us would be to lose 3-0. So we'd be ahead in that respect going into the Ashes. But it turns out that we played the fourth test match and we had a chance to win the series. We being the Australian cricket team, we not being anything that I'm part of, but Australia had a chance to win the series in India, which would have been absolutely remarkable. But some of those performances were just incredible. Like, I had some doubts about Renshaw in India, but he batted fantastically. And then obviously Nathan Lyon was heroic, and Steve O'Keefe was obviously fantastic as well, pre-incident. So there was, like, some amazing performances there, and to lose 2-1 in India, well, there's been a lot better teams than this current Australia team to lose 2-1 in India. So I thought that was probably the highlight, even though that feels like it was an absolute lifetime ago. What were your takeaway?
Well, I think just on that as well, people may have quickly forgotten how well Australia did play over there, and the context of them going there was that for once, I think they decided to abandon their kind of orthodoxy around, you know, putting the front dog down the deck and hitting guys on the full and hitting them over the top and, you know, trying to push the game forward. I think there's just been so many losses and, like, you know, disgraceful losses over there that they sort of realized they had to play a bit differently and be a little bit humble about it. And it actually worked wonders for them, to the point where, as you said, they had it all to play for going to the fourth test. And, you know, if they had pulled something off there, and obviously they didn't, you'd be talking about it as one of the great series wins in Australian cricket history, you know, throughout a long period of time. And I think the fact that they were quite underwhelming in Bangladesh, which I'm sure is related to the pay dispute that happened immediately beforehand, kind of leaves the Australian team heading into the Ashes actually statistically having won only one of their last five series and not looking that good. Right. But I just think that they that India series, at least from a character point of view, was a really big step forward for them. And I think Australia are going to be a little bit better this series than most people are giving them credit for. For me, mate, I think I'm trying to keep it like a bit of a global theme because I'm over here now in London. But there was some very important news that came through in the last couple of weeks from the Marylebone Cricket Club, who updated their laws. And I think there was a couple of laws updated that have specific reference to club cricketers everywhere, to the point where we're already seeing examples of it flying around the internet in just wonderfully aggressive ways. So I want to talk about the most important thing that's happened in cricket since we've spoken is that the MANCAD law's been updated. And
they've changed the laws of the game.
They've changed the laws of the game. And so the onus, as many people listening to the cast will know, you know, the onus is now on the non-striking batsman to remain in the crease before a bowler releases the ball. Previously, I think, what was it, he goes? So now the bowler has to actually can take the stumps before the ball was reasonably delivered. And previously there was a little bit more protection for the non-striker. And then, you know, that's before you even get into the kind of the unwritten laws of warning batsmen, et cetera. But now it's just being treated like a run out, essentially. And we've already had incidents at club cricket level. Actually, it doesn't get more club cricket than this, he goes. Footscray third grade. This was a piece in the some of the Melbourne papers recently. With 9 wickets down and Perran's Sam Hill on strike, his team, Perran, needed 5 runs off the final 6 balls. And steaming in was Merv Hughes' son. And Merv was at the game watching on. And you know what happens next. You know, his son takes the bails off Footscray win. And apparently Merv was asked for his thoughts about it from the paper. It's not a direct quote, but someone told the paper that Merv was very happy with it. He was all for it. And the Perran coach said, while they weren't going to protest it, and they understand it's within the rules and they're well aware of the changes, did say also that he didn't like the idea, but it's within the rules. You know, it leaves a bit of a sour taste, but it's within the rules. So what do you do? He goes, do you have a view on man-catting?
I've previously just hated everything about it, and I was actually reading something maybe yesterday that said something along the lines of, like, if you win a game via man-cad, what's the point of winning it when you just feel absolutely horrible for committing it? I mean, I think that actually, indicates that person would have to have some sort of moral conscience at all, and anybody who's ever committed the man-cad obviously doesn't. I've always... it's very yuck, isn't it, the man-cad rule? But I like the new rule change, actually, that it's the onus is now on the batsman. So now it's now actually like the batsman's fault if you get man-catted, as opposed to the bowler being an absolute prick. It's actually now the batsman's fault, which I like the shifting of blame there, purely from a legal perspective.
Can I introduce sort of the first flashpoint of conflict on this show? Because I just completely disagree, and with you, and I want to speak on behalf of a lot of grade cricketers who will be listening, you know, who surely will be thinking man-cad is just one of the great dismissals of all time. And, you know, what you're saying about feeling awful, I just can't identify with that. I don't really mean that. And I know what you mean because, you know, in the scheme of wickets and the way someone is dismissed from the ground, you think, gosh, it's not, you haven't really outskilled them that much. You know, you think there should be something like that. However, we do often forget that just leaving the crease early is cheating. You know, it simply is. And the onus should be on the batsman to stay in, you know. I don't really have any sympathy for non-striking batsmen who get out that way. And also, it shows such a lack of awareness anyway to do that. So
It's a shame. It's a shame that Dave isn't here actually, because I'm very confident that this has happened to him before.
Yeah.
That he may have spoken about in the past. I think Dave's actually been man-catted. So, I mean, I think you're coming from a bowling perspective. Back when you were ripping leg spinners,
good point.
That you might have always just wanted, like, if you maybe dragged a couple down, you thought, "Fuck, I just wish I could just run this bloke out without actually having to do anything." I think that's what you're coming from. Whereas me, as a batsman, just think that you're cheating,
mate. I mean, look, we're gonna talk. Yeah, that's right. Dave and I have spoken about this actually, and he said he was so scarred by it as a 12-year-old, he can't have any position other than just thinking man-catting's abhorrent. And I think I just said to him, "Why were you cheating?" Which I don't think helped. But I mean, imagine an Ashes decided on a man-cat. Yeah, I mean, just picture it now. You know, Mitchell Stark coming into bowl. And you know, who's one English batsman? Joe Root's on strike, and Stuart Broad, or Jimmy Anderson is the number 11 at the non-strikers end. You know, a packed SCG. The Ashes has gone to the fifth day. There's fading light, and in comes Mitchell Stark. You know, the field surrounding the bat, because England only need three to win, and there's only an over left in the day, and maybe there's two balls, you know, he's trying to get a run or something, and Stark comes in and man-cads him. I mean, can you imagine the scenes? I'd imagine that'd be the best result, the best celebration in Australian cricket history, wouldn't it?
I've changed my mind. There'd be a national holiday. There'd be riots in the UK.
The great man camp.
There'd be mass evacuations of all Australian expats in West London, in Clapham. That day would then be called Mitchell Stark Day for the rest of time. It'd be phenomenal. Yeah, I've changed my mind on Mancad. I love it. Bring it back in.
That is very good, he goes. On that topic, one thing we did realise last year was that while there were some times we did feel qualified to talk about cricket, there were other times when we felt like it might be better to talk with someone who is very close to the game. After the break, we're going to hear from someone who fits that mould exactly. A couple of days ago, we caught up with Adam Collins, freelancer extraordinaire, and actually we were lucky enough to have all three of us on the chat, so it will be Dave, he goes, and I talking with Collo, and I will call him Collo, and we'll hear from him after this.
We great cricketers work hard. Everything has to be hard at all times. Work hard. Circuit hard. Just be hard. Never smart. Always hard.
So we have a new element to this TGC podcast. It occurs to us that whenever we've done this show, we're just three blokes who intermittently like cricket and then sometimes don't like cricket. And it means that when we talk about cricket, sometimes we're nowhere near close enough to the game to make anything approaching a reasonable comment. So for that reason, we have decided to call into the show a few people who do follow the game closely, professionally, if you will, and it is our pleasure to have on the line today Adam Collins, who many of you will know from The Guardian, from Wisden, from the ABC, from everywhere, really, and you'll get to know him more this summer. Collo is living in London. I'll just call you Collo now, obviously. He's living in London, and he's been very close to the English side, and he'll be close to the Australian side this summer as well. Collo, welcome to the Grey Cricketer podcast.
It's lovely to be here. I'm, shall I say, long-time listener, first-time caller, as it were.
Because you have just called in, actually. Yeah, that's right. Collo, we thought we'd ask you about the English side to kick off, because you are in London. You follow them around. You're with the press pack. And, you know, traditionally in Australia, we have no idea about the opposition because we're so self-loathing and so self-focused at home. So we thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of these guys coming over to Australia, and we won't get to Ben Stokes just yet because we don't know if he's coming, but can you tell us about Mark Stoneman and, you know, Dawid Malan and James Vince and these guys that we're going to have 4 for 40 very quickly?
Yeah, well, I think they will. That's the thing. These are players who have been given an opportunity. Some of them have sustained run in the England side over the last couple of years. Trevor Bayliss, the England coach, said they were only going to turn to Stock, who played in the last couple of years, and that sort of underpins the decision to pick James Vince. He played 7 test matches last summer, and struggled. He barely got out of the blocks, never made it to 50, and generally speaking, was fairly vulnerable as a knick-off merchant and did accordingly. But they went to him anyway, despite fairly modest accounting returns this year. So it's quite confusing. Gary Balance is another who's on the tour. He's had three opportunities to play in the England side and been dropped each time. I sort of feel for Balance, though. He did break a finger. And he just looks like he might be coming into some form for England earlier this summer. So he's another player who more than likely will feature in the first test match. Milan was picked for the second half of the England summer. He looked okay at various intervals. He's a fairly aggressive player. He's mostly known for his white ball cricket at Middlesex, and now he's got an opportunity to play in the test side. But he's vulnerable. He's not the sort of player you want coming in at 3 for 50 or something like that if he does end up batting at number five. And Stoneham's probably the most accomplished of the players, although he's about the 47th opener they've used to partner with Alistair Cook since Andrew Strauss retired. They've got a real post-Shane Warne problem going there, as it were. Since Strauss retired, they keep churning through openers, but he's looked the man most likely so far. Got himself on the plane, made truckloads of county runs at a couple of different counties now and looks the part. So he may not be quite as comfortable as the others, but on the whole, they are bringing a side out here who are far from consistent. At the start of the English summer, they had three batting positions in the lineup which they hadn't filled, and they were trying to fill through the summer, and they're no closer. It's a game of musical chairs, really, when it comes to that Vince, Balance and Milan situation. They just happen to be in the right place at the right time. So not to question their capacity, but they haven't really exactly banged the door down for a tour, as you might have to do so in previous summers.
Well, Colo, I think one of your colleagues, Jim Maxwell, described this batting lineup as one of the worst English sides to ever tour Australia. Like, I'm a big fan of binary assessments, but are they probably the worst English side to tour Australia in your memory?
Look, yeah. I mean, I love the pre-Ashes phony war pantomime stuff. It's brilliant, and I always enjoy it when Jim plays his shots. So well played there. I didn't hear that comment, but I like it. I think on the basis that when you've got three of your top five, and also Ben Stokes, as you mentioned, in real jeopardy, that does justify those sort of questions being asked. Having said that, they've got legit match winners in Joe Root, obviously, who is pound for pound the best player in the world alongside Smith, Coley, and perhaps Williamson as that sort of quartet of top four players in the world right now. So you can't undersell that, nor the experience of Cook, who came out and made 700 runs in Australia a little bit 7 years ago. So they've still got players who can do it, obviously. But, there's clear vulnerabilities there, which feed beautifully into the Australian strength, which is fast bowling. And despite the fact that Pattinson is now missing out, and that would have created a glorious Fab Four had those four blokes been available at the same time. It would have been very exciting to cover and watch. But nevertheless, Stark and Cummins bowling at 155 clicks, and Hazelwood more or less landing them in a shoebox at will. They're going to find it very hard to get out of the blocks.
Colo, what about Moeen Ali, who seems to be at the moment a combination of Murali and Bradman? Is he going to bat as low as seven? I mean, like, he's just, but the wickets won't spin, will they? Like they have been in the UK for him. Like, he's just an enigma.
Yeah, as low as eight. He's batted eight quite a lot in Test cricket as well. Moeen Ali is such a complicated player. When he took a bag of 10 wickets earlier this summer, he made the point that he likes it better when he's considered the second spinner. About this sort of mind game stuff. He was playing with Dawson in the early part of the summer. And then with the bat, I mean, he's churned out well over 1,000. I think he's got 1,400 runs a couple of years ago, well, in the previous 12-month span from summer to summer, and made 400s in that time as well. So he's clearly no jobber. And coming in at number eight, this is absolutely dominant. There's always a case for him coming up and batting in the top six, but they do want to utilise him as the main spinner. So he's a complex player. I think the benefit of Moeen is that he can genuinely win a match with bat or ball. He's not a part-time spinner. I remember a couple of years ago when Australia toured England, the question put to him was that, have you finally shaken the tag of being sort of a part-time tweaker? And he sort of said, well, I've never been that. And he took offence at that. But then he's the guy talking himself down. So there's a lot internal sort of debates going on inside his own head as to actually what role he plays. But one thing, the thing we do know definitively is that he can win a game with bat or ball. And, when we know how vulnerable that England batting lineup is, as we've already discussed in the top order, having the ballast to then batting as deep as they do kind of offsets that, not least the fact that when Chris Wokes as well, batting at nine potentially, this is a guy who's got 10 first-class hundreds and made his debut as a test number six. So it's a bit upside down, but they do bat deep, so that's one of their comparative advantages compared to Australia, for instance, who are a long way from settling their six or seven.
Oh, Colo, this is just like wonderfully comprehensive from you. I mean, it really puts us in the shade when we discuss things. I just wanted to try and make it a little bit
I'm taking notes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is fantastic.
How do you
stop it, Sam?
Colo, yeah, this is about the time when we say, can we have some gloves? But I don't know what the journalistic equivalent is. can I have a notepad? No, just seriously.
Dictaphone.
I know that you do run closely with a lot of the UK press, and right now we're all waiting, as David Warner said, to find out about what the hell is going on with Ben Stokes. I mean, there's this. I mean, just to speak personally here in the UK, there seems to be this sort of underlying kind of presumption that we'll eventually find out that he's not going to play in the Ashes. But I suspect, like, it's just you know, when sometimes it's just a little bit too quiet. You know, I don't trust at the moment that there aren't some wonderful purveyors of UK rhetoric coming up with a great reason as to why Ben Stokes shall play in the Ashes. We know that this is a police matter, obviously, and that we're just waiting for that. But do you get any sense over here, or, you know, with your colleagues as to what is going to happen and what the mood is with those guys?
I just think that from Stokes' perspective, if that video didn't come out precisely what you're saying, Sam, would have occurred. There's several different storylines which have been presented, not least by Piers Morgan, about what may or may not have actually occurred that night. And I think that if not for the compelling or damning, if you like, video that The Sun published, and sort of to that end, The Sun's cricket correspondent, John Etheridge, made the point that the Australian media is fragmented state by state, so that, you know, if Ben Stokes comes to Brisbane, the circus will kick off in Brisbane, then it will in Adelaide, then it will in Perth, and so on and so forth, and it will make it hard to focus. It's not like in England where there's kind of one nationalised media pack, if you like. So there's something to be said for that. I know that the police came out again yesterday and asked for witness statements again, which suggests they haven't really got much to go with at the moment. And if there's the case that they can't lay charges before the plane takes off, maybe he does fly. I mean, you know, that's the assumption from the day this all kicked off was that he'd be charged at some point between when it occurred and when the first tour match starts later this month. But the fact that he still hasn't been charged and we're going on now 2.5 weeks, like, maybe they don't lay charges, and then who knows? Then they might have to make a decision based on more like PR rather than the law, or make an assessment based on what sort of reputational damage England cricket would suffer from having a guy who's just been involved in such a fairly, you know, brutal altercation. And say what you will about the rationale and reason why it occurred, that it doesn't detract from the fact that everyone's public, or the public perception of what happened, is that it's utterly brutal. So, you know, I think that's the sort of debate that's going on internally. Although, as you say, Sam, you couldn't rule it out. I mean, it is an Ashes series. Ian Botham did tour when he was under a similar charge some 25 years ago. Now, of course, the world's changed considerably in that time, and the scrutiny is different to what it's ever been. But, you know, you couldn't rule it out. But I think we're talking about single digits probability that Ben Stokes will be there at the Gabba on day one.
What was Botham charged with? Another tangent, but just interested in why Ian Botham was charged.
He belted a bloke as well in a nightclub. I think he was involved. I think he got charged. I can't remember what he was charged with now. He definitely toured, and then he returned back to England to face the courts after that.
Yeah. Colin, do you reckon that the whole thing in Australia, the whole thing, for lack of a better phrase, it's a shocking phrase, but like the whole thing in Australia at the moment about, you know, one punch victims and one punch attacks and stuff and coward punches and all that is so prevalent in the media. I mean, it's basically shut down Sydney's nightlife. And then you see the footage of exactly this, you know, a bloke being knocked to the ground by an international athlete. Like, it's pretty scary footage. The current climate in Australia surrounding one punch attacks actually adds to this at all?
Yeah, I do. You can't disassociate sport from the broader goings on in the broader discourse, if you like. And we know that, you know, when it comes to what's been going on at the moment with the same-sex marriage, postal vote farce, and how that's sort of pervaded sport as well, and back and forth, and away we go. So, I mean, I think the way in which we can't decouple the two, I think you're dead right. I think that if you did come out, there would be a lot of scrutiny around not just the sort of the idea of being out at 2:30 in the morning getting a punch on, but the idea that someone with, you know, I know when boxers get into altercations like this, that the law judges them very dimly for the fact that they consider a boxer's hands to be lethal weapons. Well, you look at Ben Stokes, he's built like a brick shit house. Look at his arms, but he knows the damage he could do, and I'm sure that that won't be lost upon the Australian media or the broader conversation around Stokes if he does too. That's part of the reason I don't think he will. I just think that it will be a circus, and the amount that would be lost. I mean, I think the one thing Australians don't realise about Ben Stokes is that he's legitimately the best player in the world on his day at the moment. And you get a lot of internet trolls and whatnot who don't necessarily understand Stokes because they look at his averages and they say that, you know, that he hasn't got a body of work which reflects, you know, what people say about him. But you see the way he bowled at Lord's against the West Indies a couple of months ago, and you see the way he's batted. Yep. I mean, obviously, there's the noteworthy example of the double hundred a year and a half ago, but on several occasions now for England, making unbelievable tons and in difficult circumstances as well. And he is legitimately England's best player, and on his day, as I said, the best player in the world, really, in terms of all-round capacity. So and I'm not entirely sure we quite have that across that yet in Australia, but I mean, it is a massive loss for England, but you have to offset that against how much it would detract from their broader mission if they brought a bloke out and the whole story's about him every single day.
Colo, so amazingly thorough from you. I do wonder whether bringing him out might light the fuse, as it were, just to recycle a really old cliche. But I'll just to wrap up, mate, I know we focused on England here. I mean, do you just give us a prediction of what you think will happen in the Ashes? I know that's an annoying thing for someone to ask you to do. I mean, are Australians entitled or validated in thinking this is going to be a procession? What do you think is going to happen?
6-0.
Yeah, well, 6-0 precisely. Look, I reckon the sort of light the fuse thing to deal with that first. But I mean, yeah, like David Warner and his comments over the last 48 hours, his last two media appearances, they're intentional. David Warner doesn't say anything these days unless he knows exactly what he's doing, and he wants this to be a series played on those terms, on hostile terms. David Warner's public commentary has been at complete odds with this idea for the last year or so. I've interviewed him a few times where he couldn't be further away from what he said a couple of days ago in terms of the way his life's changed and how he frames that up and the way he's been, you know, it's little things being dubbed the Reverend, but there's a reason behind that. So I know it's pretty obvious that Australia want this to be a very hostile tour, and that's understandable. It's been their comparative advantage historically, and they don't have the same sort of experienced, battle-hardened animals, if you like, who've played for 10 years and have so much scar tissue in this squad. It's a different kind of Australian side. They're basically a bunch of relatively nice young men, dare I say it. I mean, it's not necessarily in keeping with the great cricketer philosophy, but you look at the Australian side, they're not a bunch of cricks. And that's kind of like, that's not for nothing. So I think that Warner realises that in the absence of Matthew Wade, who will almost certainly be dropped, someone's going to do it. And even though he perhaps doesn't feel as comfortable over the last couple of years in expressing himself that way, that now he's taken on that role again. So I look forward to sort of seeing how that plays out, whether he sustains it through the whole test series. As to how the results go, I mean, I'm reluctant to get into the margin stuff. But I mean, when I was asked the other week, I said that like neither side are good enough to thrash the other. There will be test matches that both sides go out and lose for themselves. So I think that it's fair to assess that, you know, we'll see a test series where both teams win a test, and they get many draws these days. So hopefully it can go 3-2 one way or the other, because we haven't had a brilliant Ashes series on Australian soil, a close Australian Ashes series for you know, a quarter of a century. We sort of have earned one. We've deserved a brilliant home summer Ashes series where, and it might be the fact that neither of these sides are particularly good that might give it to us, and I think that's a good thing.
Colo, thanks so much
brilliant.
For your time.
Good stuff. Brilliant.
I would take issue with, I think Lehman would be offended by the notion that the Australian team is a good bunch of blokes, but that aside, we look forward to catching up with you this summer. Easily the best young commentator coming through, Adam Collins. Thanks for joining us on The Grey Cricketer, and we'll catch you soon.
Ever so kind. Nice to talk to you, blokes. See you during the summer.
Big day? No, big night. I've got to clean up the last two wickets, sing the song, do the covers, sing the song, drink 42 beers in the sheds, have a shower, sing the song, publicly objectify my teammates' rigs, compare sizes, tell everyone how good I was when I was 17, go to a strip club, lie to my wife, then spend all of Sunday being an emotionally absent father and husband. Big nights start with grade cricket. Lying to yourself has never been harder.
Well, it's our pleasure, and it's completely appropriate to be joined by this person on the first show of the second season of the Grey Cricketer podcast. I'd say best friend of the show, really. I mean, this guy's the guy that I brag to about, to my friends and family about knowing. He's also a guy that was the leading Shield run scorer in 2016-17 with 969 runs at an average of 73.76, but he could tell you that. We're introducing to the show, boys, Ed Cowan. Ed, welcome.
Gents, thanks for having me back. Do you have any other guests on? It seems like I'm on every second week.
Very good.
Alpha immediately.
Yeah, early alpha.
Start.
And he calls us champs. Good.
Yeah, he said gents, but I thought he said champs. How are you? But anyway, either
I said,
or.
I said gents.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
Champs would have worked. No.
All right.
Let's start.
So sensitive, Hugo. You are so sensitive, mate. That may have something to do with your current gym status, working on those pipes.
It's funny, mate. It's so funny you say that because he's on. We've got him over. I've got him on Skype here. Shouldn't really be pumping up other brands, but he keeps scratching the back of his head and thus showing off a huge right bicep. And I'm kind of finding it distracting.
Yeah, left bicep.
Turning into one of those guys. If anyone has the pleasure of following Hugo on Instagram, his Instagram stories are now like gym snaps. You know, like he's like pumping iron, say 5:45 a.m. Like. Yeah. He thinks he's like a female health blogger or something. Trying to get 2.5 million followers so he can flog some body lotion next post.
We are in the market for sponsors.
Yeah, brand integration, please. Approach us. All right, cricket at Gmail.
Well, thanks for coming on, Ted. Good luck with the rest of the season.
I think that's an inadequate response, he goes. But let's carry on. Let's talk about, firstly, something dear to our hearts. Let's pick up where you left off the grade season, Ed, before we get into greater exploits. You guys at Sydney Uni won the first grade competition last year. You made 95 in the final, I believe, because I just follow everything on My Cricket. Can you tell us about those celebrations and whether you even get nervous playing first grade finals anymore?
It was awesome. I love playing for Sydney Uni. You know that. I actually invited Higos down to watch us play the other day, but he turned it down, playing his old club, Gordon. Said he's not allowed anywhere near Gordon Cricket Club anymore. They've completely disowned him. But that's a different story altogether. So we had a great win. It was a famous victory. There was a bit of controversy the week before. We finished on top, won the semi-final, and then they moved the grand final to our opposition home ground because our ground wasn't in good enough condition, which was an absolute debacle. So we were blowing up. Lost the toss on a flat wicket. They batted for about, well, it felt like 3 days, but it wasn't. It was two. And then we had to bat out about 150 overs for a draw. Ryan Carter's, in his last ever innings, 100 off about 495 balls to save the day. Sydney Uni, Q celebrations, Devlin Malone in a duffel bag. He's about 4'5". We packed him up, put him on our backpack. Next minute, Frankie's pizza, 4 a.m. You know, eating pizza off the floor.
Just a natural circuit. Yeah. It's just what happens when you win when you win premiership.
Yeah, but this was better than just a natural circuit. You know, natural circuit is, you know, what's on, lads? Let's go to the sheaf. This was Frankie's pizza. Yeah. Special place.
Oh, so everyone was in agreement on that, or did someone led the charge, or either one kind of leading the
way? I was leading it. So it was Greg Mayle's last ever game, the greatest grade cricketer ever in the history of grade cricket. There's some hyperbole for you. So it was his last game. He wanted to go have a beer in the sheds. There's no better place for it. And so we went back and drank the grandstand dry at Sydney Uni, and then, you know, lockout laws. We had nowhere to go. And we're like, the only place that'll let us in is Frankie's Pizza. So we went there.
It's funny, we were just talking about lockout laws there earlier. I thought when you were saying Maley wanted to have, because he's Maley now, obviously, but when he wanted to have a beer in the sheds, that it was going to turn into a Michael Clarke situation where maybe one of the younger persons, one of the younger people, like the Hussey scenario. No, we're going on a cruise on a yacht. But no, you guys stayed in the sheds, keeping it real.
We kept it very real. Tears, the full bit, at home, nude showers, you know.
Right, the full bit. Right.
let's fast forward to professional matters, Ed. New South Wales JLT Cup, well, let's just call it Mercantile Mutual Cup, campaign has finished. You batted number 5 throughout the series, a couple of 50s. You just keep scoring runs. You just really love scoring runs, obviously. You still continue to do it. But it ended in controversial circumstances. So I'm watching from London. You guys play at North Sydney Oval, and Cummins and Stark,
it was a schmozzle.
Yeah,
absolute circus.
Well, they're bowling. That's really right. Well, they're bowling heat. at these guys. You're defending a very, very low total, and it's not looking good for the Blues. And then I'm just watching from the screen, and it just all sort of stops. Then all of a sudden, the New South Wales players are kind of crowded around the umpire and the Victorian players as well. Can you just, and it gets called off, Victoria would get the points because of a dangerous pitch. Can you tell us what was being said on field at that moment?
At that moment, my recollection suggests that the umpire said they were going to call the game off, and we sort of said, why? They said, well, it's become dangerous. We said, well, it's no more dangerous than when we batted. And they said, well, we think it is. And we said, well, that's because we bowl a bit faster than them.
Exactly.
And then they, no, not in a bad way. That's, you know, fact. Gummins and Stark. So it was dangerous. There's no doubt about that. But it was no more dangerous in the 70th over of the day than it was in the first. So it was, in a sense, it was the right decision. It was just the decision was made about 4 hours too late. So it was a bit of a schmozzle.
I know. It was almost like you were penalised for the skill of and like fearsomeness of your bowlers.
It was a bit ridiculous. I mean, we were very frustrated in the sense that we still felt like we probably could have won. I know the score, you know, probably thinks, they need 30-odd runs or 40 runs, we need 6 wickets, but we needed literally 1 wicket and the tail would have shut themselves. So it was going to be tighter than the scorecard suggested. I think what angered us the most was that they were awarded a bonus point based on the Duckworth-Lewis system, which didn't reflect the game. And that bonus point was enough to take them through.
How did the JLT Cup go in general? I'm not actually sure what JLT it stands for, but it's obviously their first season as the sponsor of the tournament.
Well, they're sponsoring the Shield as well. So it's now the JLT, right, just to really confuse people. It's the JLT Cup and the JLT Shield. What's the difference?
None of those are televised.
No, we don't just televise. Like we don't televise domestic cricket anymore. Why would we want to take cricket to the fans when we have the Big Bash?
You're absolutely playing into my wheelhouse. What are your thoughts on that? Is that just a terrible decision to, I guess, because back in the day, the Mercantile Mutual Cup, etc., was a great part in the, I guess, the fabric of Australian cricket. And these games recently, I looked and saw, and I didn't see many fans out there. What was the vibe like out in the field?
I think to the players, it's still an important, you know, important competition to win, and people are trying their absolute guts out. I think it's just a competition, sadly, that Cricket Australia increasingly seeing as a little bit of a cost centre and a problem in the programming. So they're probably starving it to death. I don't think we mind that it's not on TV, but I think if you're going to stream it, you know, have cameras at both ends and make a proper production out of it, it feels a bit slapstick, really, to have one kit to be watching some of the best players in the world with a fixed camera. We're going back to 1976 ABC coverage with one fixed camera. You know, I think the way we consume cricket is changing, and in 10 years time no one will be probably watching cricket on TV. So I get that aspect, but if we're going to do it, I think we should probably do it properly.
Would it be fair to say, Ted, that you think that the three of us should be commentating these matches? That's actually more a question for me.
Honestly, some of the quality of the commentating, some was of quite a high standard, some, my word, you would have been shocked. Mute. Hit the mute button.
Ted, a serious question, though, about like the actual calendar of CAs, you know, throughout the year, throughout the summer, in that they play the JLT Day Cup. It starts before the grand finals here in Australia, and then you play some Sheffield Shield, and then you stop for the Big Bash, and then you play some more Sheffield Shield. Like, it's got really disruptive to actually get into any sort of groove as especially a batsman.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, the players are pretty used to it now. The Big Bash is now an integral part of the summer. You know, it's encroaching more and more on those Shield games and getting longer. But I think guys are used to switching in and out of formats. I think it can be tough for guys who are trying to make a tilt at the Test team, and all the Test cricket is played after all the Shield games have essentially finished. And, you know, if you got picked for the Sydney Test and haven't batted for 6 weeks, if you're not playing the Big Bash, it kind of doesn't make a whole heap of sense, but at the same time, you know, for the Big Bash to thrive, it kind of needs to be in the time slot it is. I think scheduling and how the Australian summer pans out over the next 5 years is probably going to be one of the hottest topics in cricket, because I can see 4 day tests, I can see day night tests, I can see, you know, 14 Big Bash games, you know, before you know it. So I'm thinking sort of next year or the year after. I'm, you know, looking into a crystal ball. I don't think that's too unrealistic. Like it or lump it, it's probably going to happen.
So last time we spoke on the podcast, I asked you about where you thought you were at in terms of reselection for Australia, and we're sort of talking at the time about Adam Voges, who had a massive, massive season to get himself back into involved in the Australian setup, and they obviously had a very successful short career. You were the leading run scorer in Shield last season, and do you think that you're any closer? And also, you sort of combine that with where Cameron White's at, for instance, who's obviously smashing them in the one-day comp in Australia. He's probably one of the best batsmen in Australia at the moment, but yet he doesn't appear to be any closer to representing Australia again.
And you can throw George Bailey into that mix pretty firmly as well. I think you could probably track the Australian ODI performance on a downward trend the moment they stopped picking George, because he was too old, and picking guys who hadn't even represented their state. So I think, what percentage did I give myself last year when you asked? Was it like 1 or 2?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I think it's probably, you need to move the decimal place to the left. I think there's essentially no chance. I think the way the selectors have shown their hand, that they're not that interested in necessarily always picking their best team in all formats, not just, you know, before it was sort of, we'll play around with a T20 team and a one-day team. I think Test cricket, sadly, has become a little bit like that as well. So I think for the older guys who are performing, my gut feel is the door's probably shut.
I don't know why the selectors have this kind of like half your age plus seven mentality, which is the same equation that Higos has dating.
If that's less than your average, you get a game.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely. That's good, hard hitting, brutal punditry, Ed. We'll move into.
Well, I'm just waiting for the Fox Sports clickbait.
Yeah, that's what this podcast exists for.
30 cents a click.
Yeah. Cal lashes out at Sutherland.
Yeah. That's all we do. We just go to the editor after this podcast and just give him five headlines. Yeah.
You can hear the podcast here.
Exclusively. Exactly. Revealed.
We're learning about ecosystem. Let's go into something that will decidedly not be on any kind of professional media outlet, Throwdowns. But our fans like it. Ed, I'll kick off. And for those who are listening to the podcast for the first time, Throwdowns are a stupid thing where really we take attention through the question, and the person who's answering them doesn't really get to say much. But we'll do it anyway. Ed, I like to try and speak with people who know the guest beforehand and source some anonymous questions. And I have spoken with a few people. And so, with that in mind, I've got a true or false question for you to kick off. Is this true? This is a quote. Ed has clearly played his test card to find his way into the slips at Sydney Uni. He has very small hands and clearly has never been able to catch. True or false?
There's actually so much to unravel there. One, I don't feel in the slips at Sydney University, so that's fundamentally false.
Okay.
That's a.
And what about the hands? Source.
Maybe it's my brother. It must have been my brother Ash from, you know, third grade who said that to me. I've got tiny hands, and yes, I can't catch. But you know, I think statistically, if you look at the greatest ever bat pads in the history of the game, I'd be surprised if my name's not there somewhere.
Very good. I just want to clarify that that was a genuine quote. I haven't just made that up and said you've got small hands and you can't catch. I would never dare do that. I'm not like Higos who just calls you Ted really intimately on the show. But that was said, yeah. And you're sort of semi-denying it. Higos.
The full source.
Sorry, can I just caveat that by the fact that Ed Cowan Instagram me twice today asking me if he should get a haircut. So I feel like I can call him Ted.
We're buddies.
Speaking of which,
all the people. We're buddies. Sam pesters me with long form essay request questions at all hours of the day, and Dave's just an enigma. I don't even know him.
I think that's about fair. I think that's about fair.
That's a fair assessment, said, I think, about, of all our relationships.
Have you said anything? Your podcast, Edo? Are you here? I actually haven't heard your voice.
I'm on a 2-minute delay, mate. I'm just listening in. I'm going to listen to it later. I've got a throwdown for you though. While I'll chime in,
okay,
mate. In the most recent JLT fixture, you were out to Will Sutherland, who is of course the 17-year-old son of Cricket Australia CEO James. I'm just wondering what hurt more, getting out to a child or getting out to a child whose dad used to be your boss.
Technically, he's still my boss. You know, there's one. It's like when you take your boss's kids to the nets and you let them knock your middle stump out of the ground, hoping you might get a pay rise next year.
That's very good. That's very good.
In that pace, do you think he kind of allowed himself a wry smile when he streamed the game live on cricket.com and saw your dismissal?
Well, he wouldn't have, because the camera would have been behind, I reckon. So he would have been like, I wonder if that's my... Is that my son bowling?
Is that my son?
I wonder who's batting.
At least he was watching his son.
He would have been screaming, but I don't know. He would have got much out of it.
Ed, you were quite vociferous in the players' pay dispute, arguing the players deserved a fair share. What colour is your Range Rover?
Oh, no worries, Michael Slater. It's a big red Ferrari, man. with my service station sunnies on, just cruising the street.
Ed, just another true or false one from an anonymous source. You've, inverted commas, never received any Sydney University Cricket Club kit, and you often warm up in a uni shirt with New South Wales or Cricket Australia shorts.
Occasionally. There is some truth. It depends, yeah. My kit management around certain things has been poor, and if no one has brought shorts for me, i.e. my mate Nick Larkin, who captains the team, then sometimes it's casual shorts. Might be a little Lululemon number, might be, the cargos. Sometimes it might be, there's a whole range of...
What a brand drop. Good.
Lululemon, that's a sight, that's a thought,
Ed, have you ever been fielding and want to watch a guy score 100?
Yeah, the whole time.
Who specifically? Ian Bell?
Not Ian Bell, no. Although he's very aesthetically pleasing while batting. Yeah. It's usually one of, if you're playing against one of your mates, you hope that they get absolutely dicked on, but they get 100. When we played Tassie, I always hope George gets 100.
That's nice.
But I hope they lose inside 2.5 days.
Yeah.
Ted, Ian and I had the privilege of joining you for a beer recently-ish at the Lord Nelson. I was really surprised to see you guys, and you were there with all your Sydney Uni teammates, just having dinner, engaging earnestly with each other, probably about a range of different topics, not just cricket. And it seemed very clear to me that you all enjoy spending time with each other in a social setting. And I'm just wondering what that's like to be friends with your teammates.
Refreshing. Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. Normal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Healthy.
Yeah.
I just wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. What's it like having friends? Okay, Ed, this could be the last one. I don't know if you have one, but we sort of have covered it, but I'd like a more detailed response for you. So just a hypothetical. Say Australia are 4 for 90 against England on Boxing Day. England have a 2-1 series lead. Jimmy's hooping them. Steve Finn's bowling quite quickly. And the Australian number 6 emerges from the dressing room at 4 for 90. Who should be striding out? Cartwright, Maxwell, Stoinis, Moses, Travis Head, or leading shield run scorer Ed Cowan?
Austin Walker.
And so just to clarify as well here, Ed, I'm not asking what you think will be the case, but who should be striding out?
Clickbait, 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 clickbait.
as a general, I quite like the idea of actually playing a batsman at number six, believe it or not. Let your batsman get the run. Yeah. You know, this infatuation with all-rounders to bowl two overs a game, I think can be done with. Why don't we pick the best next batsman to bat at six, whoever that is.
Who is it?
Whether it's young Curtis Patterson or Joe Burns or, you know, there's a whole range of people that you could pick to bat at six. But and it may well be Hilton Cartwright, who's a fine batsman in his own right. But to kind of label the whole thing an all-round experiment, I think, I don't know, maybe this is why I'm not a selector. But that's what I would be doing.
Mm. That's a pretty good answer. So okay. not yourself. What if you hit the ground running?
Still digging.
Yeah,
still digging. Yeah.
Need a left-hander in the top order.
Left-handed.
It's not happening, boys. So I would love it to happen, but it's not. That's so you need to relinquish those dreams of getting free tickets for the Boxing Day Test.
Saw right through us.
See right through us, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, Ed, it's, you know, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on, and, you know, for your earnest and hard-hitting comments. Thanks for joining the Great Cricketer Podcast and, like, basically still being friends with us and knowing us.
I love you guys. Good luck with the clickbait. Let's hope, you know, they go crazy on those cost per clicks.
CCP.
Jeez.
Are you upset that no one comes to watch you play cricket? Are you tired of no one appreciating you for the talented third grader you are? The Cricket Family is the first program dedicated to helping people like you feel relevant again. We have a database of over 1,000 out-of-work actors who can come to your games and masquerade as your friend, girlfriend, wife, parents, or grandparents, helping you create the perception that the people close to you actually care about what you do.
Great shot, Jason.
No, I'm proud of you, son. The Cricket Family, helping cricketers feel relevant once again.
Fantastic to have good friend of the show, Ed Cowan, on, and of course, Adam Collins as well, speaking insightfully about the state of the Ashes coming up. I mean, everything is heading towards the Ashes. But before then, Pez, before then, probably the biggest date in all cricketers' diaries is October 25. And why is that? Because the great cricketer, Tea and No Sympathy, of course, hits bookshelves. I mean, you can pre-order it now. This feels like a really bad, like, tire commercial that I'm just flogging.
Yeah, continue on in that vein, I think.
Everything must go. So I think this is our podcast. We can do whatever the fuck we want. So it's something we've been working very, very hard on the entire year. A lot of people asked for a second book. We were very privileged and honoured and cashed up to write a second book, and that was a real privilege. So we've been working really, really hard on that for the entire year. And Pez, I speak for all three of us, I hope anyway, that we're extremely excited for the release to come out. So we thought we might just spend a couple of minutes talking about the process of the book and what the book's actually about. So maybe, Pez, you might be the best person qualified to actually talk about the title, Tea and No Sympathy. What does that even mean?
Yeah, what's that weird shit? Yeah, and let's just say from the outset, you can probably already feel, listeners, that this is a completely awkward and strange thing to do, to shamelessly promote your book. I hope that it doesn't really come across as a promotion. We just wanted to talk a little bit about how it came together. Tea and No Sympathy. Well, what actually happened was that we were, and you know this, he goes, because you were there, but we have these Skype meetings weekly. And we were we had these Skype meetings weekly, and as much as bringing the book together was actually a really smooth, like, excellent, funny, enjoyable process, the process of finding a title wasn't as much the case. Like, we each came with about 50 ideas and kept cycling through. One day we might post those ideas, because some of them are outrageous. Yeah. But sort of got towards the end and we needed to find a title, I think, I don't know what it was. He goes, I think you might have said, I might have said Tea and Sympathy, because I was thinking about afternoon tea and I was thinking about Bernard Fanning. And then I think you might have said Tea and No Sympathy, or it might have gone the other way around. I don't know. And And it was funny. I thought, oh, that's actually a famous movie. It's a famous 50s American movie. And I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I saw that the themes of the book. Basically, what happened was
Wikipedia'd our book.
We wikied it. No, we watched the movie, and we found that it was a. It's a movie about a guy who's trying to be different in a college dorm and in a frat house, essentially. And he's ostracized by a big group of men for being different. And not only is he ostracized by his mates, but he's and sort of pressured to become like them, but also he's ostracized by his dad, who used to be part of that. And we thought, gee, there's a lot of parallels here with what we're doing. And he found sympathy from a woman, a group of women, and he found a way to be himself. And so we do feel like there's some similarities there, but I probably sound like a rare unit, which was my choice for the title. But I probably sound like a rare unit talking about that. Really, it does continue in the same vein as the first book. You know, we'd like to think that you could close your eyes, open the book randomly to any page, and put your finger on something, you know, on a word or a paragraph, and something wild will be happening. We think it'd be something that you'd enjoy reading over Christmas, or you know, and we think that the cover is sufficiently friendly that you know, unsuspecting aunties will also buy it and give it to their nephews who will never want to play cricket again. So if we can do that, then we'll be successful.
We're ticking a lot of boxes, yeah. It's funny that, I mean, someone actually tweeted to us, or maybe they tagged their friend in it or something, and they were like, I get the feeling this is going to be the most relatable thing I've ever read. And I think it was Dave who pointed out, like, the way this book starts, if that's true, there's going to be police knocking on your door. That's all I'll say. So I don't want to give away any spoilers. It's certainly a wild ride, this one. I feel like just from a literary perspective, that the first one was almost much more instructional. I mean, we obviously went through the Grey Cricketer's life, like his life timeline, went back into his past and into his childhood and his relationship with his dad, and all that was pretext to current day, which is where this book is sort of more set. It does go a little bit into the past, as you I think the fans out there would be happy to know that there's a lot of Nugsy in this book, and he's without a doubt, from my own perspective, my most fun person to write about, because he's everything wrong with society.
there's a lot of Nugsies out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of Nugsies out there. There's a lot of dad in this, and there's obviously a lot of TJC and all of his angst. But I think the most important thing is that, like, of course, this is a cricket book in that the main character has this relationship with the game, and it's something that everyone who's going to read this book is going to have some familiarities with, and maybe there'll be some affirmation in there as well. But I like to think that this book, even more so than the first, is a lot more about everything, in that it's not really. About cricket. It's not about cricket jokes. Like, there are cricket jokes in there, of course. There are cricket jokes in there, but it's much more of a commentary on, like, social interaction and you know, relationships with each other. And I don't think this book is just a book of cricket gags. I think we wrote it with the intention of it being about everything, not just being about cricket, right?
Mm. Yeah, well, let's just, you know, this is why we're talking about it, just to help it not be a failed sequel. And so, thank you for enduring us talking about that. Like we said, it comes out in bookstores on Wednesday. You can already pre-order it now. And if you are in the UK and you want the book, there is an answer to this. While it won't be in bookstores for this UK winter, it will be for the next summer. However, if you want it now, go to Booktopia and you can order it without any extra shipping, exactly the same price as everybody else. And you too can read Tea and No Sympathy when it gets dark at 3 p.m. In the afternoon. Yeah. Into the winter.
I think you can also get it from a website called readings.com.au, and also our publisher Alan and Unwin, their website is also going to ship it to the UK as well. So there's obviously a lot of people in the UK who want this book. I think there's even some people in India who want it as well. Pakistan, I think I saw one guy. So you know, it's the internet, you can get it. if you listen to this, fair play to you. To that end, to try and make this a successful sequel, we're going to give away some free books, and
an odd business model, you might say.
I mean, you will have to pay for postage, which is $85. No, of course, that's a joke. So Ask TGC is our upcoming segment. It's one of our favourite segments to do because we get to answer your silly questions and we get to alpha you. But we've decided that the best model is, like, the question that we enjoy the most, they will be receiving a free copy of Tea and No Sympathy. And so I don't know. I don't know if that's going to encourage more questions to come in. Maybe no one's going to write in anymore because they fear they might get a free book through the post.
Yeah, we keep talking about the book for about 40 minutes every show, which we won't, by the way. That is the longest we'll ever talk about it.
You won't.
Why don't we kick it off here, guys? Can I give you the first one?
Kick it off, Pez.
Okay, so this is from Bees, BHEAZE 6425. Oh, yeah. High-grade cricketer. Always funny to be called grade cricketer. High-grade cricketer. I'm having some work-related issues. I work at one of the largest banks in Australia and speak to customers on the phone. When I speak to customers on the phone and provide them exceptional service, I call them champ to alpha them. Is this okay? He goes.
You do get champed a lot in telecommunications, don't you? I mean the big ones are baristas. They're the number one perpetrators of the champ. Then I would say bus drivers, and then it's probably going to be people that you speak to on the phone getting called champ. Is this okay?
Can I throw one in there? I think PE teachers.
It's faceless. PE teachers.
I think they have a union of champs. It is interesting, though, because I used to work in the telecommunications sector, he goes, and the complaints and I know this guy's from a bank, but, you know, when you're just talking about big businesses and customer service over the phone, the complaints usually aren't about being champed. However, you know, to be earnest about it, I'd much prefer to speak with someone who knows their job really well, even if their English isn't that good, rather than be champed by someone on the phone. So I think it's is this okay? No, not at all. Genuinely have a look at yourself.
Correct. Let's move
to the next one. This is from, he goes, this is from Tom Morris, who some might know from Fox Sports, friend of the show also. Tom writes, and this is relevant, he goes, does grade cricket need more context to bring back the fans? And I'll provide some sub-context to that, he goes. This is in relation to the announcement of the new Test Championship. Again, that word. The new ICC Test Championship that is going to run over 2 years and result in points and a finalist in a bid to bring more context to Test cricket. You know, so Tom's asking, does grade cricket need more context to bring back the fans?
I think that we've been providing a lot of context, and I think, once again, grade cricket is losing fans.
The question presumes that there were fans to begin with. Were they ever there?
You would have played in some games where, particularly against lower socioeconomic teams, where the families come out and it's like extended families are there and it's like a full day out and there's legit like 25 family members of about 6 players at the game. So that's some of the biggest crowds I've ever played in front of. So I don't know what the point of me saying that was.
Well, you're essentially equating us as a social media fictional entity to the ICC Test Championship in that we both provide context. So, Tom, I hope that answers the questions for you. Yeah, does it need more context? Well, that's an insult. We think we're the context, so I don't know what you meant by that. But this is actually interesting, he goes. I say actually interesting as opposed to everything else we've been talking about. But this is from Andre Leslie. A question from Andre has come into the show, and he said, why hasn't grade cricketer changed its name to premier cricketer in the off-season? Didn't you get the memo?
I think if we did that, we'd just lose followers. I think that's literally the answer. So
Well, this really grinds my gears, this one. He goes, like, this makes me angry. And like, we did get the memo a few years ago that Sydney grade cricket was falling into line with the rest of Australian cricket by rebranding itself from grade cricket to Premier cricket. And we were so incensed by it. I remember this, he goes, we went out to lunch to discuss this. Though you came down to Melbourne when I was living there and Dave was living there, and we went out to lunch and had some drinks, and we seriously considered making a formal submission to Cricket New South Wales opposing this name change, not least because it would make us irrelevant immediately.
We actually discussed making a change.org page, didn't we? That rings a bell now that I think about it.
That's right. And maybe we still can. If you would get behind that change.org page, you should. And I'll tell you why you should get behind that. Premier Cricket is like a farcical rebrand. It is like trying to market grade cricketers is like anathema to what grade cricket is. You kind of, you know, trying to make grade cricket cool is really like completely opposed to the point of what grade cricket is. You sort of... Mm-hmm. Like the whole point of wanting to get out of grade cricket, it's like the slums, you know, like you want to get into professional cricket so you can feel cool. You need something that isn't cool to juxtapose that. I probably could explain that better, but I just don't think I oppose grade cricket trying to look cool and look premier, mainly because of followers.
Well, I think the point is that you can change the name as much as you like. It's the same shocking blokes turning up every Saturday.
It is. It's like changing clubs, isn't it? Like, people always wanted to change clubs for a better opportunity, and you just always thought, you always said to them, like, yeah, but you're still playing against the same teams every week. You're still coming out in the same situations. Every grade club is the same bloke, has the same blokes and the same dynamics. You know, like, environment means nothing. So anyway, same attitude. It's homogenous. Oh, good. We're getting angry now, he goes. This is good. Okay. Speaking of dealing with anger, because I feel like there's a bit within this question, even if it's not apparent. Mm-hmm. Paul Edwards writes in and says, grade cricketer, after 5 years away from the game, I joined a friendly league with work. What on earth does that mean?
Yuck. That's great. That just encapsulates everything. That's
Australian brilliant. Cricket.
Yeah,
he's that's definitely Australian from cricket. Australia.
Yeah,
I wonder if he's working in London.
So he played. So he played 5 years of. What did he say? 5 years of.
He's been
cricket,
5 years away from the game, and he's now discovered
the game.
This concept of friendly leagues. And he, I think he's been asked to do it, and he just kind of disputes the premise. It's like an oxymoron, friendly cricket.
I love it. I know the type of, like, when you play like in a work league, you know that you have those like little lunchtime competitions here in Sydney. They're like down at the Domain. It might be like a touch footy or like a little five-a-side soccer comp or something like that. And it's like there's always one bloke who takes those competitions so seriously, and he's like arcing up at like his colleagues who are essentially more senior than him, but on that field he's the alpha dog. But even though he's just the male boy at back in the office for KPMG. And there's just people who like take it so seriously, like they tackle girls, or like, you know, and I can imagine the same being said for a friendly league of cricket, where it's Australian men getting out there just trying to enjoy the game, but they can't because you can't enjoy cricket in Australia. You're not allowed to. Got to be good. Be good or fuck off.
That's right. That might be the title of this show, actually. Now that you've said that twice. He goes, I think that will do for the questions. Can I just read a few comments that came in? Actually, no, there was one other question. It was, hi, sir, can I buy your page for $4,000? we get that on our Facebook inbox.
We've spoken about about this in the past. But, yeah, people actually do write into us and ask to buy the page.
Yeah. But you have to befriend them first, apparently. Then I think they'll steal the page. So if a great cricketer starts pushing out Russian-sounding articles from various news outlets, et cetera, that are sort of poorly spelt and not to do with great cricket, it just means we've taken the money. And by taking the money, I mean being scammed and the great cricket is over. So we're just saying that now. A couple of people did use the hashtag RTGC.
The book, we took the money.
Well, that's exactly right. As long as we get money from the second book, money. we make like 30 cents a book. Just be clear about that. We are not cashed up. You see that he's been in the rules of podcasting, Higos? Can you talk about this? Please stay with us. There were a couple of comments that came in, Higos, with the hashtag AskTGC, so it kind of, again, you know, defeats the invitation. But I just wanted to read them out. Some of them are so strange. But Brandon Thompson has just written, "The feeling when you score your first ton in a losing team and your old man wasn't there to see it, ... tragic." Take it or leave it.
Should I leave it? Like, is
just a comment. I'm just trying to give a sense of the landscape of commentary into the grade cricketer. Daniel McNabb. That's the thing with grade cricketer, isn't it? You don't know whether to laugh or cry with so much of it. He could genuinely be upset, or he could sort of be seeing the lighter side of it. The written word is difficult like that. Daniel McNabb attached to My Cricket a screenshot of My Cricket with a scorecard, and he's just written to us, was playing a game on the weekend and one of the opposition batsmen who opened the batting made 4 not out of 65 overs. Was the most fucked thing I've ever seen. And then told us about it.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah.
4 not out of 65 overs, not even balls, 65 overs.
Yeah. That's insane. Can I tell a story about this, Higos? So I was talking to a few UK colleagues over here recently, and they told a story about one of their friends played grade cricket in Queensland. It was a UK guy played grade cricket in Queensland, and he played third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned up to this game a few years ago, and opening the batting for this opposition third grade side was a 14-year-old, and it was sort of known that this kid was coming through, you don't see many you see kids, you know, in grade cricket, but you don't see 14-year-olds. And anyway, he batted the entire day for something like 65 not out, and absolutely copped it from everybody in the opposition side, and just said, you know, that's not how you play cricket. And he clearly just didn't have arms or any power to score runs. But the UK guy was extremely impressed, and apparently as he was walking off, went up to this kid and said, you know, that was class. Turns out that kid was Matt Renshaw. So, you know, kids, if you're out there and old men who have got nothing better to do with their lives are getting angry because they can't get you out, it's not because of you. It's because of them and their lives. And you never know, you might open the batting for Australia one day as well. I like defence. I like 4 not out of 65 overs. There's nothing that annoys me.
That's a fucking brilliant story. I don't care if it's a lie or not. That's a brilliant story. Pez, that reminds me. Do you want to speak just really quickly about, well, when I say speak, do you want to just listen to me speak about this bloke who got 307 out of his team's 340?
Yeah, I want to listen to you speak about
that. Going around the traps the other day. Like, there was, so maybe for our UK listeners who haven't seen that, it was posted around the internet. So one team scored 340 in a 35 over game or a 40 over game or something, and one man hit 307 of those runs. And he was described as local grade cricketer scores three, and it's like, no, that's not fucking grade cricket. Like, no one playing with any level of any competency is that game a grade cricket match. Like, can you imagine like a proper game of cricket where one guy gets 307 and the next top scorer is about 6? It doesn't happen. It made me feel angry. It's just like one of these things where like it gets confused as like grade cricket, but it's actually fucking yuck park shit, you know?
Well, it's park cricketer, isn't it? Here goes. Maybe we won't go into that, but I wonder how. I mean, again, just to bring everything back to us, you know, this is what fame does to you guys. But yeah, just to bring everything back to us, I wonder whether we've clouded it as well, because we try. You know, on the one hand, we try and sort of broaden the grade cricketer to be this commentary on club sport generally, and I wonder if, you know, people in the UK and overseas now just equate any level of non-professional cricket as grade cricket. It's not, you know, we're very proud of playing grade cricket. We wouldn't be trying to sort of work on our therapy 10 years after our careers if we weren't, or considering change.org petitions or submissions to Cricket New South Wales to keep the name. But, yeah, that is park cricket, and it's distinct from grade cricket, and it's very important, if you're listening to this for the first time, that you make that distinction for my own sense of security and self-esteem.
Grade cricket is Shane Watson is playing great cricket at the moment. So that's that. If he scored 300, his team would score about 750. They wouldn't be all out for 310.
I think he did make 185 the other day. But yeah.
Yeah.
My favourite way of trying to explain to people that grade cricket was actually good was to actually highlight the times when professional players didn't do well. So you know, every time I see like Shane Watson sort of 3 years after his, long form career making heaps of runs, it makes me think, oh, maybe the pro players are much better.
Grade cricket's not nearly as strong as what it was, though, man. Like, and that's definitely true because people just aren't playing. I mean, this goes into a deeper thing of like people aren't playing cricket past the age of like 23 in Australia anymore. Like when you were coming through and playing first grade and stuff, like the average age of first grade would have been much closer to 30, whereas now it's much closer to about 23. So there's just that lack of experience, which is going around. And then of course, like with like international schedules and state schedules now and the Big Bash, like the state players rarely actually play grade cricket anymore. So whilst it is still a very strong competition and they do occasionally come back, especially at the very beginning of the season, they do actually play for their grade clubs. It's not nearly as strong as what it was perhaps when, you know, perhaps sort of even 10 years ago. But that's probably a different conversation. That's not funny.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we start to panic when we get earnest, don't we? That is where we miss Dave, I think, actually, to be honest. He may be back on the show next week, folks. It'll just be one of those things where we'll see who's available and run it that way. But I think that's probably all we've got time for, Higos. Thanks for joining us on our first hit out. Hopefully we haven't turned you off too much. It's good to get back into it. And thanks for persisting with us in the context of a slightly different technical setup with this. Hopefully the sound is still pretty decent. You enjoyed listening to Cowan and Collo.
Pez, who do we give the book to?
Good question. Look, I liked the undertones of Paul Edwards' question about joining a friendly league and saying what on earth does that mean? That's a very pithy way of saying a lot about the way cricket is played in Australia.
Any oxymoron I'm on board with. Paul, you're getting a free book.
Well done, Paul. And now what do we do with that? But let's deal with that off air. All right. We'll see you next week. It should be coming out on a Thursday morning, pending technical proficiency. We'll catch you then.
See you next week.